Thanks, Lene. I'm Pat Ault, and I chuckle at the name of my department because they've moved us twice in the last 2 years, and we've had three different department names. So I can sort of remember what it is from one minute to the next. My background is more health policy and some aging stuff and ethics and legal issues in healthcare, and used to work for the state health department. And I've also been on a hospice board for quite a few years. Okay, how do I do it? Okay. So I did the disclosure thingy. Basically, I was asked to talk more about, sort of generically, about how tricky it is to build support for this kind of policy, not necessarily this particular APHA one, but in general, how do you go about getting people to even think about some of these questions? And I must admit, this was put together, you know, at the very last possible minute, at the deadline last week, so I should have spread them onto more PowerPoints. They're a little bit crowded. Basically, one of the big issues is, of course, clarifying the terminology. What is it we're talking about here? You tell people that you're talking about palliative care or hospice care, and they go into this thing about, you know, death panels or whatever. So they get all confused about what is it we're really talking about. And then the Affordable Care Act does have some new provisions that have the potential to clarify some of those distinctions. But in the process of, when we proposed this paper back last spring, everything seemed a lot tidier than it is right now. So a lot of this is like, and last week, blah, blah, happened. So things keep shifting under the ground underneath us. And some of them are still being revised, and who knows what's going to happen in January, so there we are. But Bailey, basically, just to start out really simply, which most of you probably already know this stuff, palliative care is talking about maximizing the quality of care for people in pain. And hospice is a form of palliative care, but it's limited to people who are terminally ill. Current Medicare coverage for hospice under Part A requires certification by two physicians that the patient is likely to die within 6 months, and the patient has to give up insurance coverage, including Part D if they have it, for life-prolonging treatment. The current system was set up assuming that if you went into hospice, you went into, you know, only end-of-life care and you didn't take your insulin or whatever anymore. There's been a great increase in use of hospice care in the U.S. and institutions and home-centered, but the data is really messy about the quality of care. And interestingly enough, as I was pulling this together, the Washington Post started publishing this series of articles, which I recommend to you all, in September and October this year, about what they called the business of dying. And they examined a lot of CMS data and tried to determine the quality of care being provided. And they concluded that it varies really widely and is not consistently reported. Oops. Meanwhile, the Affordable Care Act, in Section 3004, requires hospice providers to report extensive quality data to CMS. CMS is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I guess everybody knows that. Should have probably put it in here. Both about their quality assessment and performance improvement programs, usually referred to as QAPI, and about the implementation and measurement of appropriate pain relief measures. However, there's a lot of howevers in these PowerPoints. The process of collecting and reporting that data has not been finalized yet. Medicare is currently collecting comments, again, on a form that's going to be called the prior authorization form for beneficiaries enrolled in hospice. The aim is to use this standard form to facilitate coordination among different kinds of providers to the same patient, Part D sponsors, hospices, and prescribers. So if somebody goes into hospice and they are still taking other meds, this form would try to make clear what the whole deal is. Would be required for four categories of drugs that are generally covered under hospice: analgesics, anti-nauseants, laxatives, and anti-anxiety drugs. In March of this year, CMS launched a pilot program called the Medicare Choices Model to allow hospice patients with certain conditions to continue to receive curative care along with hospice care. It doesn't really cure them. That's also funny terminology. These conditions are advanced cancers, COPD, congestive heart failure, and HIV/AIDS. That will allow hospice organizations, which are selected to participate, so they are, you know, in the process right now of picking which organizations get to do this, to receive a $400 a month fee for per beneficiary for services that aren't separately billed under Medicare B, A, B, and D, and they'll also be able to continue to bill Medicare for the reasonable and necessary, thank you, curative services they furnish. And they're going to have to decide what reasonable and necessary is. New measures are being developed. CMS now has a hospice center website, and I went and looked at that. It has a lot of information about tools and regulations, but a lot of it is, you know, basically still in progress, meeting next week, blah, 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 you know. The prior authorization form is on there, the hospice experience of care survey, and this QAPI data, hospice quality reporting program data, collection tools of one sort and another. So they're trying to unfold this in a good way, but it's right now it's still sort of being gelled, I guess is the word. The overlap between Part D and hospice has been a complicated area. Because hospice care is a Part A benefit, drugs provided by hospice have not been covered under Part D. And of course, Part D is optional, so you don't have to even have it. I have a friend who teaches at the University of Maryland in the pharmacy school, and she refers to it as part dumb, but that's another whole issue. having a prior authorization form in place is aimed at easing the coverage documentation issues so the patients could receive needed care, but clarify who's going to pay for it. So you don't have to wait around until they decide who's paying for it to get the care, or wait too long anyway. If you're in hospice, by definition, you want to decide things fast. And then this survey, the Hospice Experience of Care Survey, CMS has developed this survey to gather information from the primary caregivers of deceased hospice patients about the quality of care given, including the experience of the patient, the caregiver's own experience, and overall rating of the care provided. This is supposed to begin in January 2015. There's a lot of interesting stuff out there. After initial dry run, the idea is to sample primary caregivers of deceased hospice patients several months after the deaths, and hospice would be required to participate in the process on a monthly basis. So they'd have to report to CMS, you know, who died in your system this month. So here's some questions, and these could go for a whole lot more panels, I mean a whole lot more slides, but I smooshed them all into one. So will the ability to simultaneously receive hospice and curative care blah, under both Part A and Part D be beneficial to the patients? Or are they going to wind up in such struggles over what drugs are okay and not okay and who's going to pay for it and blah, 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 that it may or may not be a big help? Will the requirement for more consistent reporting of care provide clearer standards for hospice and palliative care providers? And what are the challenges and barriers for advocates, such as our section, as we seek to monitor and encourage consistent and beneficial care if at the same time you're exploring all these different new methods? I'm not saying anything against these efforts. I'm just saying that we're in a kind of an interesting state of flux right now.